I want to start this morning with something that is going to seem a little off topic, but this is how I want to work my way into it. This is a section from Noel Mehring's book, Awake, Not Woke. In the parenting section of the Washington Post, a feminist writer wrote an essay in 2016 accusing her sons, her own two sons, of being part of the problem of a misogynistic system. The woman described herself as a single mother who had suffered sexual abuse and who regularly talked with her teenage sons about consent and misogyny and rape culture. One night, as she discussed these topics with her sons, one of them rolled his eyes. She felt that was a dismissal of the conversation and symbolic of her sons refusing to take sexism seriously. That article went viral, and her two teenage sons started to receive angry texts, and their friends started treating them differently, thinking of them as representatives of toxic masculinity. The woman's two sons went to her and they said, we're embarrassed and we're angry. And after hearing that, she wrote a follow-up piece in which she said that her sons were strong and compassionate and good. But that regardless of those virtues, they were not safe for women. Quiet misogyny is still misogyny, she said, and by virtue of being born male, they are guilty. She titled that second article, I'm Done Pretending Men Are Safe, Even My Own Sons. Okay. When I read that portion of the book, my heart just broke for those young men. And I felt like their mother was really out of touch with maternal instincts, if not with reality itself. But here's where the conversation becomes relevant to today's topic. Mehring says that the shift from sexism based on one's actions to sexism as inherited, like original sin, falls right in line with woke ideology. She says that woke ideology would like us to believe that it's impossible to be a really good man, just like it's impossible to be a really good white person. That books like White Fragility teach us that racism comes woven into Caucasian DNA. That foundational to being white is being anti-black, and that to even question the legitimacy of those ideas in the midst of a woke revival is to place yourself outside the bounds of polite debate. I started with something I thought would give us a little bit of distance and then moved us into, and like I said at the beginning of the service, it's not so much what I mean when I say woke, because I'm going to live my life the way I'm going to live my life. But if everyone who hears woke is hearing it as a threat, is hearing it as an extreme idea, like there is no such thing as a white person who is not virulently racist, then we've got a problem. I asked our friend Al to step into this divide with me. And when we met to talk about this, I said, Al, I don't want to put any expectations on you. I hope that you will feel safe, that you can be honest, that you can tell us what you need us to hear as your life in a black body. And so I want you to know that we didn't set this up in a particular way. We talked about some different ideas, and then Al Al prepared for this, but here's the kind of thing I threw at him when we went to lunch. I'm sure he enjoyed this. I said, Al, this is the kind of thing that I started wondering about. So, like, I'm going to throw them all out here. Like, when you first meet white people, do you make assumptions about them? And if you don't make assumptions about them or about their being racist to some degree, do you think that white people are less likely to be good friends or potential partners? Or do conversations about race figure early on in your relationship with white people? Or do you find yourself paying attention or asking questions to see if we're safe? Do you expect us to need to have our work done? What is it? Because here's what I'm trying to get at. How can I act in such a way that my friend Al sees things like compassion and listening and willing to learn and those things, because the relationship is very valuable to me? So I'm just going to have you take it away and kind of give your, you know, tell me what I need to know.
Okay.
And not all of it, I know, because yes. Al does not represent, he made this phrase, Al does not represent every black person in the universe.
Yes. Yes. I always like to say my experiences are my experiences. My experiences come from my lived life, my lived experiences, my journey, my interactions. And so that comes from me. And so I share from me. Different people have different opinions. These are my opinions. I once heard someone say, everyone has opinions, and sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. But for me, that's a lot. That's a lot of questions. I think, let me step back into that to that story for a minute. So woke is something we hear all the time. And I think it's been used as a sword. It has become a sword where people are using it to put up defenses and walls, and they hear woke and all things are off. And so what I always say for folks, let's talk. Let's communicate. Let's listen. And when we do so, how do we talk without coming into a conversation without defenses, or coming into a conversation already made up in our mind what we want to do? So kind of some of my thoughts on that is our systems, we live in systems. The United States, when it was set up, there are systems. There are school systems. There are housing. There's medical. There's financial systems. And those systems, when they were set up with a purpose, and that purpose was to, was set up with the purpose, and it still has that purpose today in many ways. We're trying to change that, but the purpose was to defend and protect white people, or white men in particular. And some people don't agree with that. What I'm asking for you is to listen and hear that, because that is a real thing. When you look at cities, look at Austin, and Austin was divided by race. And it wasn't just black folks, it was Mexican folks too, but those systems were set up that way. We still have that. I shared with Reverend Karen doing the monkeypox scare. I went online and I typed monkeypox, looking of what it looked like. Not that I had thought I had it, but I wanted to know what it would look like on skin. And I had to look and look, and then I put monkeypox in on black skin. And our systems are set up that when you make a search, if you pull out your phone at any time and search for something, you're going to have to be very specific to find instances where it's my skin.
So you found images of what monkeypox looks like on fair skin.
On fair skin, absolutely.
Hundreds and hundreds. But you couldn't find what it might look like on black skin.
Yes.
So it's skewed that way.
It's skewed that way.
And I wanted to say, when you talk about Austin being divided on race, you can go back and you can read the history now, right. And you can find that, you know, I-35 was basically your dividing line. Mm-hmm. If you lived on the west side of I-35, you had adequate sewage and plumbing and electricity. You moved over to one of the things that have on the east side of I-35, the sewer pipes were about half the size, mm-hmm. and there was that was cheaper, and there was constantly. Sewage problems and those were those were just the way it was.
Absolutely.
Not so long ago.
Yeah, not so long ago. And there was evident. I've been in Austin for 40 years. How many people have been in Austin for 20 years? How many have been in Austin for 30 years? 40 years. So you've been here for a while. You know this stuff. If you go on the east side now, and it's much different than it was. It's changed. Things are changing. We're changing. And that's good. There are things that are changing along the way. We have a lot of work to do. A whole lot of work to do. But so my experience is, I've experienced things that I've been said, or in terms of race, what's been spoken to me or about me, the actions that have come towards me, and then the systems that we live in. I've experienced those things. And what I think oftentimes, in addressing that, oftentimes we are so quick to and eager to fix the problem without understanding the problem. The fix always needs to happen. We have to fix things, but we have to understand what the problem is, because the base is what caused the problem. And I think oftentimes when we talk woke, folks are hearing that, and that's the problem. But there's something that's underlying the problem, where that came from. People say, I used to say it all the time, I like change. I think that we don't really like change. Change is not something that humans like a whole bunch. Anybody else say, I just love change. And I say, do you really? When you're going to work and the highway has changed and it's inconvenienced you, how many of you like that? when you had something all planned out, and there's something that comes up, and now you have to change something last minute. Some people are really comfortable with that. I'm pretty comfortable just ad-libbing and jumping in. Not very many people are. Now, I'm comfortable. I'm not as well prepared, and we like to be prepared. And so I think it's important that we understand that we need to fix problems, but we also need to figure out where the problems come from so that we can fix the root of that problem. And I think a good portion of that, one of the deals that we talked a little about is the anti-racism training. I don't think every person needs to go to anti-racism training. Do I think that it benefits people? I think it absolutely benefits people. But what I feel like every person needs to do is understand racism and understand the root cause of it in America specifically, because that's where we live and those are the systems that we live in. But we need to understand that and try to understand the history of it, because the history is there. Part of not liking change, sometimes we stay away from looking at things that make us uncomfortable.
We talked about some of the, if I heard you right, that that need to rush in and fix, I think a lot of times on the part of white people, it's some shame, mm-hmm. and some guilt, understanding that we have privileged positions and privileged lives. And then I think sometimes we want to rush in and we fix it and then don't realize our impact is not the same as our intentions. And sometimes I think we shut down because of shame or guilt that we're carrying. And I don't think you think that's the place we need to come from.
Absolutely not. Shame and guilt doesn't. I was a product in my early days of shame and guilt. I went up to the altar like 20 times to give the Lord my life because I was shamed and guilt and going to hell. And that does not. That doesn't bring joy. That doesn't bring hope. That doesn't bring resolution. And that doesn't. That's not the truth we need to live in. So yeah, shame and guilt does not fix anything. And we don't need to approach from that point. We need to approach from a point of taking a deep breath and say, here's the problem. We can't fix the past, or we can't change the past, but we can repair some of the things that's happened in the past. We can do better. Maya Angelou says, when we know better, do better.
Right.
And that is so important. If we know that that something is not right, say something about it. If we see something that's not right, one of the greatest frustrations for me oftentimes is folks see things and it's easier to be quiet. Mm. And we're beyond the point, I think, where we take the easy road. We have to stand up and challenge things that are uncomfortable and things that are easy and say, you know, if we want change, we have to do more. And sometimes doing more isn't easy, isn't comfortable. But yeah, I don't want people to feel shame. I don't want people to feel guilty because that doesn't change anything.
We talked about public places, and when you walk into a place, you pay attention. Mm-hmm. Who's there? White butt. And you told me about a friend of yours that you feel like, face it, in Austin, we very often walk into places that are mostly white. Mm-hmm. And you said that you have a friend that enters those situations in a way that you think is really good.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So he will often, he's in a place, and he comes from this place of wanting people to feel accepted and comfortable. And so he makes a point when he's in a bar or in a meeting or in a social situation of making sure that he goes over and introduces himself to black folks and make sure they feel comfortable and introduce them to other people, and he goes out of his way. Some people have said, oh, that's disingenuous. That's
he's white.
And he's white. Yes, he's a white guy. And in his approach, how he does it is very natural, very comforting, and you don't see that. But on top of that, and that's relationship also, he doesn't just do it there. If he sees an advertisement and he has the ability to say something, so very often you'll see advertisement from companies and it's full of white people. Oftentimes it's full of really, really buff and strong, the pretty folks. He will tell them, hey, this your advertisement, you say that you're trying to be a welcoming and open place. Your advertisement doesn't look like that. And he'll say, you need to do it again. People will ask him to be an advertisement and he'll say, there's enough white guys in there. I don't need to be in it. Find someone else. And that's something that you can do to make a difference. So when he comes into a place, he's going to make sure he reaches out. He's going to make sure you feel connected. He's going to make sure that he's introducing you to people in a way that you are feeling comfortable. He's an ally, but so much more, because he's not just an ally in that moment. Okay. He's an ally in life.
This is going to sound extreme, but I think we do things like this. The black person in the room doesn't want to hear that you loved white fragility, you know, doesn't want to hear that you've done this work or that training. But let's really living life together. Al describes his friend. He makes his way over to say hello, to introduce the black person to other people, to help them step up and step in a very organic, honest kind of way.
Absolutely. And he'll, you know, Shirley Chisholm, congresswoman back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, said, early 80s, said, if they won't give you a chair at the table, bring your folding chair. What this friend will often say is, he says, if they won't give you a seat at the table, I'll give you mine.
Yeah.
And that's what we're looking. And what I often will say is, don't just give me a seat at the table. Give me a part of the table. I want to be a part of it. I want to have some power in it. I want to have ability to make change. If you're going to ask me to table and just want me to be there, that's not going to work for me. And you're going to soon find that, oh, we got to get them away from the table, or we need to change how we're acting and doing at the table. One other thing that I talked about our country and racism, another quote from Shirley Chisholm, she said, racism is so universal in this country, so widespread and so deep-seated, it's invisible because it's so normal. And what we have to do is we have to make it to the point where we know it's normal. We have to make it where it's not invisible. We have to talk about it. We've got to call things out when we see them. We see the big things that happen. And when I talked about fixing the problem, we see shootings, and that's a problem. What's the root of that shooting? We see people with racist rhetoric. It's just, I think, more than I've ever heard in my entire life. And we have to figure out what that problem is and say that isn't normal or say that normal isn't okay.
Yeah.
That normal is not okay.
And then sometimes on both sides we overreact. One of the other things that they said in the book was that, and you know, Noel Mehring, who wrote the book, thinks wokeness is a cancer. It's killing the U.S. And she says this: wokeness has raised the ideology over the individual. It's extreme and exclusive. So here are some examples she gets: a woman who is not a feminist is said to be denying something central to her womanhood. A conservative gay man is not allowed to represent the gay community. A conservative man of color will have his blackness questioned. We need to make sure we're not swinging so far in the other direction that we are, you know, seeing the theory, seeing the political over the individual. We can be guilty of exclusionary thinking as well.
Absolutely.
On the liberal side.
Absolutely. On both sides, you know. And again, there's these extremes, and extremes rarely ever make a big difference. Because if you have your extreme and I have my extreme, we're across the room yelling at each other. Where what we need to do is we need to come, and I would often say, I think it's in a perfect state in the U.S., there is a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. Because then they've got to come to the table and communicate and talk. Well, it used to be that way. These days it's a little different, but I believe we can get back there. And what we need to be, rather than standing on the sides and screaming and yelling, we've got to come, because no actions happen when we're on the side screaming and yelling. Action happens, and change happens, and things that not only better, I think this is one of the other things that I'm always reminded of. We are all better when we are all better. If we're holding one person down, we're losing talents and abilities and skills and dreams and hopes that someone has because we're excluding or keeping them down or holding them down. There is so much more that we can do together, so much more we can do when we come together and talk and grow and learn. And I think the other deal is oftentimes when we're in conversations and someone's talking about their opinion or talking about their feelings, oftentimes we're in this head of, oh, how do I make that better? Or how do I fix this? As opposed to listening and understanding. And so that's one of the other things that I always ask. How do we stop, listen, understand what they're saying? At that moment, the key is not how do I fix this, what they've just gone through, but to understand this is what they've gone through. What am I going to do to understand that, see why that happened, and then do something to make sure that doesn't happen again?
We're going to hear the choir sing about listening. And one of the things I wrote down for today is a quote from Brené Brown, who says, "We need to dispel the myth that empathy is walking in someone else's shoes. Rather than walking in your shoes, I need to learn how to listen to the story you tell about what it's like in your shoes and believe you even when it doesn't match my experiences."
Absolutely, absolutely.
To listen to each other.
Talking about walking in people's shoes, I had someone say one time, they said, you know, we often place expectations on people, and they said, even if you put on my shoes, you can't experience what it's like for me, because I'm an individual, I'm unique. So you can put on my shoes and walk in those shoes, you can't experience it. So rather than walking in my shoes, how about you walk alongside me? Yeah. And that's about understanding. How do you understand me and walk with me? And walking with me may simply be walking quietly and let me point out the issues, let me point out the things that are there that are bothering me. And then, just as I would expect you to do that, I should stop and let you do the same thing. Point out the things that you're seeing. Oftentimes, we see things through different lenses, and we'll never see what they're seeing unless we stop and listen and hear and give them an opportunity to be them. It's so important that we approach. So you mentioned, so when I walk into rooms, I will walk into a room, and I will often look to see, am I the only one? So one of the interesting.
Are you the only gay man, or are you the only?
Am I the only black man? Sometimes am I the only gay man? Yes, but am I the only black person in there? I will walk into rooms, and I will. How am I treated in that room? How am I received? How am I? I mentioned to Pastor Karen. Oftentimes, I heard someone say, oftentimes when a black person walks into a room and they're the only black person, it's a little different than when a white person walks into a room and they're the only white person, because
walk into a room, they're the only white person in a room full of black folks.
Okay. Is that oftentimes, and this is about systems. Oftentimes, the black people in a room are trying to figure out how to make them not feel like they're the only white person in a room.
Oftentimes,
that's not always the case when the black person walks into the room. And I say it should be. How do you normalize that on both sides? Mm-hmm. On both sides is important. I'll go walking, and I've walked on town like for years. For years and years, started out walking on Town Lake. Walked on Town Lake with many of you remember John Meisner and Jason Honich. I walked on Town Lake with them, and I walked today. And throughout that time that I've walked on Town Lake, and this is a very normal thing, I say hi to everyone. I just smile at folks. But it is extremely rare that I don't walk past a black person and they don't look at me and smile or say hi. And it's that knowing look of, hey, look, you look like me.
We share something.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so I walk on there. Next time you're walking on Town Lake, and this is what I ask people all the time, is when you're walking in life, people say, how can I help? How can I be an ally? How can I kind of change some things? Just when you're walking and you're doing something, pay attention to the discrepancies. Pay attention to the change. The next time you search something, pay attention to what it is. Can you do much about that? Most of the time, no. But when you have an opportunity to do that, when you're walking into a place, look around and say, is my skin the only color skin I see represented here? And ask questions on why. Are you trying to fix it at that moment? No, but you're just noticing. Yeah. And so what I want us to do is, which I find helpful, is to notice that. I think because when we start to notice that, then when people start to talk, we start to say, oh, yeah, I can understand where you're coming from now because I'm seeing things that I was not seeing before. Mm-hmm. When you walk into a room. Now, knowing Austin, the percentage of black folks in Austin has been declining over the years, so it's going to be quite normal.
Seven percent.
And that's just Austin. So note that you're going to see that often. But what I always want folks to do is to acknowledge it and recognize it and call it for what it is. Not saying you got to fix anything, but just notice that. When you see advertisements, notice those advertisements. I often now, when some company is saying, hey, follow me on Instagram or follow me on Facebook or follow me here, I'll go down there still and I'll see what's your advertising look like. And if it all looks like you, and none looks like me, one, I'm gonna message you and say, hey, I'm not gonna follow you because I don't see myself represented there. Mm-hmm. And two, I'm gonna say, fix that, and I'll follow you, and I'll cheer you on, and I'll support you. But what I ask for folks is to notice those kind of things. And if you have an opportunity to say it, had someone say, hey, we want to send you a shirt, and I'm looking. Okay, I'll wear your shirt. Let's see what else I'm seeing here. And my question may be, why are you asking me to wear your shirt? And because what I don't ever want to be is that token. I've been that enough in my life. I'm too old for that. I'm too old for that. If I'm being invited to be in, I want to be a part of what the real meat of what's going on. Yeah. And so that becomes with whatever I'm doing, whether I'm serving on a committee, or whether I'm being part of a group, or whether I'm wearing a shirt for a company, or wearing shoes for someone. I want to make sure that it's not just, we want
tokenism.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We're going to start moving towards the end, and I want to tell y'all where this title, My Best Friend is Black, came from. A few years ago, I read a book called We Are Not Like Them, and it's a book written by a black woman and a white woman. And it's fiction, but the black woman is a TV journalist, a news reporter, and the white woman is married to a white police officer, the white police officer is involved in the shooting of a young black man. So you've got this black journalist, and you've got this white woman married to a white police officer. They grew up together. The white woman had a very broken home, grew up in the home of the black woman's grandmother. They're sisters. And then this happens. And so the black woman is reporting on this crime of this white police officer. So things are heated, as you can imagine, and the scene is at the home of the white woman and her police officer husband, and the press is just all over it, and just, you know, is your husband a racist, and we've read this, and blah, 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 blah. And she comes out to address the press, which she shouldn't, but she does. And they are throwing these accusations at her, and she says, and you're just ready for this. You know she's going to say it, and you just know it's going to be horrible. She's listening to them talk about her. Is your husband racist? Are you racist? Do you hate black people? And she says, my best friend is black. And you would think that she had thrown blood in the water, because that was the worst thing that she could say. Right? We've heard this. We've heard this ideology because I wrote this down so I would get it right. There is the belief out there that proximity to blackness immunizes white people from having attitudes that are rooted in racism or doing racist things. So there's that piece. But we say there's another piece to it too. And then we're going to get to our scripture here. And Al is going to read some words that are going to be familiar to all of you, but listen to these.
But Ruth said, do not press me to leave you, to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do thus to me, and more as well, even if even death parts me from you. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. Ruth 1, 16 through 19.
You know those beautiful words, right? You hear them at weddings. You hear them whenever love and loyalty and all about. So what I want to remind you of this morning is what's behind those words. 10 years before Naomi spoke those words, she and her husband were living in an area where there was a tremendous famine. So they took their family and their two sons. They took their family with their two sons, and they immigrated to the country of Moab. Now, the people in Moab were Moabites who didn't worship the same God as Naomi and her family, who were outsiders, different. And while they are there, Naomi's husband dies. And her two sons have married Moabite women, not like Naomi and her husband, just a different country, a different God. Her two sons have married Moabite women, and her two sons die. And these two young women say, we're going to leave our country, our families, and everything we've known to go with you back to your homeland. And for the first time, I was really thinking, what about that? Not what she says, entreat me not to leave you. Your people will be my people. But what led to that? Well, 10 years of being family, 10 years of relationship that bridged this divide between their nationalities, between their religions, 10 years. So I'm starting to think that, you know, if a whole lot more of us could say my best friend is black and it be based in an honest and loving relationships, the world might be a better place.
Absolutely.
And I don't want us to think that that's all it takes. There still is work to do. And part of what I said to Al is if all it took was living with someone, being in relationship with someone, loving someone, if that's all it took, then I would never see a 16-year-old boy sitting in my office trying to figure out what to do after his mother threw him out of the house for being gay.
Right.
Because he'd had 16 years of relationship. So there has to be some undoing. Sadly, often, a lot of times, undoing of things the church has taught us. Undoing of the systems and the things that have operated on us, the conditioning that we don't even know we're exposed to. There has to be some work in that area too. But is there anything you'd like to say to help us finish up? What's your great hope for all this, Al?
So my great hope is that we realize that sometimes things need to be taken apart and put back together. Sometimes things to be taken apart, taken down, and new things erected. I was in New York 2 years ago with a friend, and he was talking about this building, and I was like, why don't they just blow it up? That's what they do in Austin. And he says, you know, they decided that building has reached its life. It's done everything it can. They're putting a new building there. And I said, just blow it up. In Austin, they just explode. He goes, you got the subway underneath it. And I went, oh. And he goes, so what they have to do with this building, they've got to take it apart piece by piece, piece by piece, piece by piece, and then put up the next one piece by piece.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes the things that needs to happen is we need to realize that some things have to change and some things have to go. Some things we can take down and remodel and refurnish, but sometimes things need to be torn down piece by piece, and then build up. I think that's when we realize, and that takes work. Mm-hmm. That takes effort. That takes time. And changing systems that we live in, the systems that this country was built on. Folks will say the country's built on, was built as a Christian nation. A nation. Look at that. Check that out. That's not entirely true. There were Christians involved. But that's not entirely true. This nation was built by people who said, let us worship like we want to. Let's be free to worship. And that's important. So, yeah. And go and look that up. So what I'll say is there's work that has to be done. And what I want everyone to do, and my hope, is that we do the work and that we're willing to not stand screaming at each other, that we're willing to work. And I sit down and I will talk with anyone. I will talk with the most conservative person in the world, the most liberal person in the world, and have conversations. And my hope is that when we walk away from that conversation, that one thing, if not a lot of things, but at least one thing has changed, and they walk away with a better understanding of me and what it means to walk in my life, and that I walk away with a better understanding of where they're coming from and what it is walking their life, and that we're meeting in the middle and we're causing change to happen. So, yeah.